Welcome to the Ackerman Center podcast.
As a digital extension of the Ackerman Center, our goal is to teach the past so we can change the future.
In doing so, we address issues related to Holocaust, genocide, and human rights studies from diverse perspectives.
Welcome to the Ackerman Center podcast, and this week is the annual Scholars Conference, and we're sitting down today to have a fantastic conversation. My name is Katie Fisher, and I am a Bielowski Fellow at the Ackerman Center, as well as a PhD candidate. Normally, I'm jumping in from time to time on this podcast to ask a couple of questions, but today I get the privilege of being at the mic. So if you would introduce yourself to our audience, it would be fantastic.
Hi, Katie. It's wonderful to be here. I'm Charlotte Chalier. I'm a professor of German and a chair of the Department of Germanic and Slavic Studies at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, Canada. I'm a Germanist and historian who has started working with arts-based research methodologies, bringing them to the fields of Holocaust studies.
And if you could just give us a little bit of the overview of the project that you talked about last night, the graphic novel, the survivors that you worked with, and then sort of the output of that project so that our listeners can understand your fantastic background in this topic.
So thank you for allowing me to do that. I have to start a little bit earlier because I came to this project by not using arts-based research. So I have been conducting eyewitness testimonies in a more traditional way using oral history methodologies. I've been interviewing Hungarian Holocaust survivors, those that were saved in Budapest by Swiss Vice Consul Karl Lutz in 1944 and then early 1945. And so the way I set it up was having 1 to 3 hour interviews and then recording them and then making them available. And I really remember my research assistant who was in touch with the survivors and kept telling me, oh, they're sending me messages on WhatsApp. They want to stay in touch. They want to know what's happening. And I thought, why? I recorded the interview. I transcribed the interview. I edited the interview, sent them back for approval. Why does they need to stay in touch? And then I realized there was something wrong with my flawed, with my research design. There was a great need to be in touch. There was a great need to think about my obligation toward the survivors. I needed to consider reciprocity. I needed to consider care and attention and consideration. And at the same time, and I'm really blame my son for that. He was 11, 12 years old. He loved comics. He didn't want to read, but he really found comics totally accessible. I kept purchasing them for him. I went to the library, went to the bookstore. And that was really when I so there's so much interesting material, social justice, human rights, comics. Of course, I knew Maus. I didn't really fully explore the possibilities. And so here it comes together. I love art myself, but I never considered it a research methodology. But then I thought, you know, here is comics. How about if we pair a Holocaust survivor with an artist and we have to work them together over an extended period of time? Now, I was not interested in having a set testimony illustrated. So that is a possibility, but I thought, what happens if the artist actually spends time, builds a relationship, gets to know the person who survived the Holocaust, gets to know the person beyond the experience of the Holocaust, and we as a research team, we learn together. So we consider this community-engaged research, arts-based participatory action. These were all theoretical concepts for me that were important because I needed some funding. I'm saying that because without funding, projects like this cannot take off. It's expensive, it's multi-year, and so I applied to the Social Sciences Humanities Research Council of Canada and started to think about the possibilities. I'm really, really grateful that we got initial funding for that. And from that point on, that was just started at the beginning of the pandemic. It's been all a learning process for me because unlike you, I don't have any theoretical, methodological background in arts-based research. The work itself convinced me that this is an incredible, useful tool of critical inquiry.
Before we get into this process of arts-based research, can you say a little bit about the 3 survivor testimonies that you worked with?
So this was also guided by the process-based work. So I had existing contacts in the Vancouver Holocaust Education Center. There was my colleague and friend Ilona Schumann-Spahr, and I know Jan-Erik Dubelmann from the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam, and I know Matthias Heil from the Ravensbrück Memorial. And these were a really critical link, because I could not just connect with survivors out of the blue. I need to earn their trust first and foremost. So I connected with my community liaison and said, that's on my mind, that's a project. I don't have money yet, don't have funding yet, but what do you think, who would be open to explore a project where we are committed to do this work together, but we don't necessarily know what the outcome will be. And so the three community liaison then said, yeah, we'll get you in touch with survivors that we have been working with and who we think are comfortable with this approach. It was important for me that the survivors had some experience and felt comfortable sharing their story in public. So it wasn't a first-time event, which could be extremely traumatic. So I had a sense that it would be more intimate, more demanding to have that longer relationship-based approach. So I wanted that they felt comfortable in principle. And the artist was also very interesting. And so I had like all of us favorite artists that I thought I loved their style, and I thought they would complement each other well. But, you know, I had nothing to show for. I had no research work done in this field. I have no name in comic studies. So again, I had to just reach out to the artist, and I hope I'm allowed to say that. So one of the first ones I reached out was one of my all-time favorite graphic novelist, comics artist, and that's Barbara Jelin in Germany. And I didn't know her agent, so I just connected with her on Facebook Messenger. And I love to tell that story because she's so lovely and gracious and kind. She responded. Yeah. And she said, yeah, let's talk about that. And she recommended Gilad Seligtar, who is based in Israel. And so I connected with him, and he got very excited when I mentioned Barbara would be on board. And then I have to apologize to Miriam Libicki, because I was really looking then for a Vancouver-based artist. I thought it's important, an Israeli artist, Europe-based. And it's true. She tells the story, but it's really true. I did Vancouver-based comics artist, and her work popped up right away, and I loved it. And so I reached out to her as well. It was not easy at this early point because I had no money. It was a dream, and I was looking for historians, educational experts, Holocaust educators, human rights educators who wanted to submit the application with me. So I'm very, very grateful to have the artist saying, no, you can put down my name. I'm interested in working with you.
Mm-hmm. And can you say a little bit about how you structured those interactions? So you mentioned in your talk last night that you did, and you mentioned just now, you didn't want it to be prescriptive to say, this is the story illustrated. So can you talk a little bit more about the way that you cultivated that relationship between the artist and the survivor they were sharing? And what did that look like as they were going through the process of creating the work?
Yes. So here I would like to stress again that it was, I'm part of a team, and we always use a team-based collaborative approach. So I remember early on that was right before everything shut down due to COVID. We had a meeting, a workshop at the University of Leicester, which was the location of our research partner Alexander Korb, and it was so interesting. It was actually intended to familiarize the artist with his geographical research methodologies. And very early on, we realized it was the artist that taught us about how to connect with very difficult and challenging stories. And that, in a way, started the community building, trusting one another and also telling the artist early on, here is your support network, you can rely on us. We had student transcribers, student assistant. So it started really to build a cohesion within the team, which I think was absolutely critical. And then so my own role was to connect with the artist. I'm always here. Any questions, you can connect me on WhatsApp. I know the three of them early on met very regularly on Skype. And my other role was to get in touch with the liaison and organize the first meeting. So they had very few one-on-one meetings, in part because the budget was limited, and also we couldn't travel anymore. So for me, it was always important that the liaison was part of it, was the confidant, because I felt if there was any tension in the artistic creation process, which is almost to be expected, that the artist could always come to me or could always come to the liaison. So it in a way sheltered and protected the relationship. So I thought in terms of risk management strategy that I was the one that could be consulted for, mm-hmm. for any tension and issues. I really learned that project like this is not, conflict resolution is not by avoiding conflict, yeah. but by actually having a design where that's brought into the fold. But again, I'm learning by doing. I'm very conflict averse myself, so each time there was an issue, I panicked. I have to say, early on, I thought, I'm sure this is the moment that everything is going to fall apart right here and now, but it didn't.
Yeah.
It just kept going, and the more we worked through it, the stronger it became, mm-hmm. the more committed it became, and I realized that these tensions, these points that created productive tension actually helped us understand this work much better.
Yeah, 100%. And in my own practice as an artist, I know when I've gotten into the core of the issue, the crux of the problem, because there's some tension, there's something that's not working out right, and it's the moment where you think everything could fall apart. And if you can make a project without hitting that moment of thinking, I'm crazy, why did I start this? If you don't have that, then you don't really have the density of topic required for something that's a larger project like this. I need those points to move into them. But something brilliant that you did was to say, the conflict will happen. This is where the conflict belongs in the project. And to put it somewhere specifically so it could be sorted out, you know, in the relationship structure of things.
And of course, the community liaison have lots of experience with that. And so it really helped me work through that process. And then as a result, realized that it actually strengthened everything in that work together. I really have to say the work of the three artists was stunning and extraordinary, because none of them has worked in a setting like this. Mm-hmm. And so we had human research ethics approval, consent forms, and the only stipulation that we gave the artists is the survivor always has the last word. I have to apologize when I say survivor. It goes against a core principle of the project is actually to see the story, the life beyond the experience of survivor. So I should say Amy R. Bell, who worked together with Barbara Yilin. I would like to acknowledge and honor the participation of David Schaefer, who worked together with Miriam Lebicki. David is based in Vancouver. Amy R. Bell is based in Kiryat Tivon, Israel. And Nico and Rolf Kamp, both are based in Amsterdam. I work together with Gilad Selektar. It's really the artist treated these testimonies, interviews, recording, I don't even know how to call it, these conversations with utmost dignity and respect. Mm-hmm. And I think one why it also happened, because we early on talked about it, and we said the project is larger than all of us. Mm-hmm. So even though the artists had absolute artistic license, mm-hmm. They needed to check with the survivor. So if the survivor would have said, if Emmy, David, Nico, and Rolf would say no, it didn't happen, but they had to redraw, they had to redo it. And I reminded myself not to interfere in the process at all. My colleagues do, I said, look, there is project where artists come on board as illustrators. Mm-hmm. We don't want to do that.
Yeah, we
want to learn through the process. And so what started to interest me is, are these artists asking different questions? Mm-hmm. What does a trust-built, sustained engagement with Emmy, Nico, Rolf and David look like? Is that different, and how is it different than an interview that I would have done in a more traditional setting? And here I want to say it because I might forget about that. So project, I learned, is about reciprocity, but it's also about relationality. So when we say we build relationship, What does that do to the concept of memory? Mm-hmm. So if you see a traditional interview, oftentimes, you know, it literally is a frame around the person because we film it, mm-hmm. and the person looks into the camera, mm-hmm. and the viewer is either perceived as the attentive listener, or there is a suggestion there is actually a conversational partner there, but the relationship that's unfolding between the two is largely, not in all interviews, but largely erased, mm-hmm. because there's just no time to build that relationship. And so I was wondering theoretically, methodologically, if it's about relationship, we have to acknowledge the presence of relational memory, mm-hmm. and what would relational memory actually look like, mm-hmm. and how does that emerge in a graphic novel?
Yeah, and how does it emerge with those particular personalities as well? So you mentioned this as a medium, and last night you did a good job of saying that graphic novels are not a genre. Can you talk a little bit about the ways that graphic novels as a medium can be a suitable container form for dramatic memory?
Again, I learned that from my three artists, and in particular in Baba Yelin's story with Amy Arbel, But I Live, and now the follow-up book, The Color of Memory, shows that what is not being said, what is being contained, what is being embodied in a person has a space, has an expression, has a color. And Barbara Yelin is able to hold space for these memories that Amy can no longer express, mm-hmm. or experiences predominantly as a sensory memory, experiences predominantly as an image, as a color, as a sound, as a trigger. Again, a traditional testimony will not capture that. So when I did, going back to my previous work as an oral historian, so I will answer the question. I had this very unruly testimony, because nobody remembers in a linear chronological fashion unless it's a highly prescribed, scripted, commemorative speech. So then I had all these sections that kind of didn't work together, and I had to press it into what I consider to be a coherent narrative, so it became a testimony as edited by me. Mm-hmm. Now, the graphic novel, this does something completely different. And again, that is the artwork, the brilliance of the artist. So in the case of Amy Arbel, it holds a strong presence. It's almost a non-memory. Mm-hmm. So it's there, it's in her, and she says, I know it, but I don't remember it. And oftentimes she keeps saying, I don't remember, I don't remember, I don't remember. Again, if I have a testimony like this, I won't leave the survivor telling me 50 times, I don't remember, so I completely erase that. Barbara did not erase that. So it's there, and you can see empty panels or very abstract swipes, drawing, and you can see almost the figurative representation of Amy Arbel dissolving, disappearing into the color. Mm-hmm. And that would be the presence of the traumatic memory, or the body or the soul or the spirit of a person saying, I'm not going there. This is my self-protective shield. But the artist, and that's the power of the art, the art really can hold space for that experience. So Amy's testimony is 5 pages. I cannot say that enough, because I'm still utterly shocked myself that a 5-page testimony first led to a 40-page novella and now to a 164 graphic novel with 900 drawings. That tells you everything about the power of a graphic novel.
I'm also struck by what you're saying in there is essentially she's made space for the void of emptiness, which in this case is empty memories. And there's some, you know, Holocaust representation and mass atrocities associated with that, which can completely fill essentially the frame with or noise, and in many of these films that are coming out about the Holocaust is bombing. It's really action-packed, and we expect that the more that we cram into that space that where we're representing the atrocity, then we've succeeded in some way. But personally, I find that the voids created by the Holocaust to be almost more overwhelming. You walk around in Berlin, you'll see empty spaces, I think. But spaces where Jewish life used to fill in homes, and then that being pried off and burned and removed. And it's the erasing of it that leaves a void. And what you're describing in this is that she made space for that void in the testimony. And the weight of that void is really where we can like hold our breath along with the person who's sharing the testimony.
You so succinctly tell it so beautifully. So Barbara comes from a tradition of counting memorials, yeah. From very abstract representative models, and James Young has written extensively about that. So we have the Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe, and we have Berlin full of these representations of history that really are meant to for the visitor to critically engage with a history that can no longer be compensated for. These lives are gone inevitably, but they leave something behind. And so you cannot put a very figurative traditional memorial there. This is also the country of the perpetrators. So it's nothing to glorify. You can't, how do you draw attention to your own atrocities collectively, individually? And so I think counter memorials are a very effective way of creating tension, of creating a sense of discomfort, of creating a sense of unease. You know, the Memorial to Murdered Jews of Europe, kids jump around on these stelas. I don't have any problems with that. People do hide and seek. It might be inappropriate, but at least it engages the space. And it, I never asked Barbara, but it may very well be that she's very sensitized, very attuned to this, to creating a space, holding space for something that is really an irretrievable loss. Mm. Now, the beauty of that work is so we have an extensive public collective memorial culture, and to some extent, some scholars would say it's not working that well. Now we have the rise again of right-wing governments, racism, everything. So what's going wrong? And then I would say, I think you're expecting too much from Holocaust education, from anti-Semitism training. However, I think what Barbara does so well, it's about a personal relationship. It's not about reconciliation. It's about a personal relationship between a German artist who has also a very challenging history herself, of which is written about in Yamina, and we have a Jewish child survivor. And what happens in that space, the rawness, the honesty, the care, the love, I think it brings something that Germany as a whole has explored on a collective level to a personal, private level. And I think there's just not that many initiatives, not that much work. And the book, But I Live, was really very well received in Germany. I'm not saying that to padding our shoulders, but because I did not expect it. I did not expect that it was a receptive for a little bit of an innovative project that uses art. I found it astounding that so often the review was it in the Süddeutsche, in Frankfurt Allgemeine, in Zeit, and in others. I couldn't believe it was reviewed in so many newspapers. Oftentimes it's a comic, but it works. Always the disclaimer, but, and I really, and Lars von Turner, who's a fantastic journalist, he gets it, and really he writes, and I fully believe her, it's a comic, and that's why it works. It's an ideal medium. So not just to show the void, which is of course very critical, but it also ask the artist to bring themselves into it, to in a way ask them to make it autobiographical, because they're impacted. And I think the reader needs to see how they are impacted. The artist, of course, they're all very modest. And they said, I don't want this to be a story about you. I said, it's not, but it's a story about the relationship. And I think the reader, particularly young reader, how do you bring them to a story like this? Through the care and the consideration that the artist gives the survivor, I think it's a segue for the reader. So the graphic novel is very good, not at showing the void, what can no longer be represented, be it in language, in a caption, a speech bubble, in a visual representation, but also showing how it's mediated. So you see that the survivor tells the story, and then you have the artist recreating what the survivor just said, so the visual representation, plus an actual conversation in the past as well. So you have at least three or four elements on one single panel. Where else can you do that? And where else do you allow stillness? So you mentioned movies. So we have the problem here with Holocaust appropriation. Huh? So you said it's about action-driven, not much time for contemplation and thinking. It's a heroic narrative structure oftentimes. You know, these are journeys from darkness to light. They bring a great moral lesson with them. But that's not what we ask our survivors to share. We just wanted to share them with us. And so to have the stillness of that graphic novel, and so the reader, and that's again the enormous potential of graphic novel, the reader, being young, being middle-aged, being old, can read it at their own pace and can allow themselves as deeply or as superficially to engage with what's in front of them. And that holds great potential for classroom use as well.
I'm reminded of another thing that you had mentioned last night, which is that there can be different times within the speaker's history, all within the same page. And that's often the case with traumatic memory. It's not linear, and it doesn't just come as a story that you can easily follow, but it comes back in flashes and in by triggers. And I think we often assume when we hear testimony that it has something to do with a legal proceeding, which is incredibly important. I'm not trying to say that it's not, but we also need testimonies that are embedded in communities and this within relationships, and that has immense power as well.
I really believe so. So my mentor is Hank Greenspan, who's been doing incredible work with arts-based work with survivors for 30-plus years. And he really was at the forefront of saying, this is art, it's not just ornamental, it's not something that we add. It's not an afterthought to existing research. It is research, but he would not agree with me. He doesn't like the use of the term testimony exactly because of that. So for him, it's retelling, it's schmoozing, it's all of that. But what I hope that we can actually reframe, reconceptualize the word testimony and not see it in a legal context, but maybe open ourselves up and say, what could other forms of testimonies look like? And they are as powerful and maybe this non-binding, but how can we maybe even bring different, more humane forms of testimony, giving, sharing into the process to really even begin to understand? None of us can understand an experience that is so traumatic. It's really, we can always approximate it, if at best, but what we can do is to be with the survivor in that space, share it with them and do it in a sustained practice, have an understanding of an ethics of care framework, and then maybe down the road there's a different understanding of what a testimony actually can be like. Mm-hmm. And that a testimony encompasses much more and does not limit the person giving the testimony to scenes and experience of utmost dehumanization and degradation. You have a beautiful example. So the project has now got more funding, thankfully, and has a follow-up project. And we also produce short films here too with this project. We also produce three short documentaries again. We gave the filmmakers artistic license. And so with the new film, I work with a wonderful Korean-Canadian filmmaker, Jerome Kim, and there was a scenario when the survivor talked about saying goodbye to his three cousins, and they were deported to Theresienstadt and later further deported to Auschwitz and murdered. And there was a scene where we asked whether we could show pictures of the cousins while the survivor talked about that this is the last time they saw them. And the filmmaker said to me, I don't want to show the name, the cousins, and only have them referenced through the experience of their demise and their death. Yeah. And that really stuck with me very much so. And maybe I should add, I've been teaching about the Holocaust, representations of the Holocaust, for many years now. And I've shown atrocity photography in class. And at one point, I was not able to do it anymore. So maybe it should have been an answer to a question in the beginning. I was about to give up. And then I remember my wonderful a colleague, Helga Thorsen, saying, how about we start a Holocaust studies graduate program? And then I thought, oh my God, no. We're just about to give up going back to teaching something where I can laugh and have fun. And then somehow the graphic novel project just came at the same time. And it's radical for me to speak about joy if it comes to Holocaust studies, but this is a joyful project. Mm-hmm. It's radical to think about. I care and love this participating survivors. That's not concepts I've upheld in the past. It was always about objectivity and critical distance. I did not want to emotionally manipulate my students. Mm-hmm. And early on, I showed them all these horrific photographs because I wanted as if to say, this is a serious class. And just to know that it's a serious class, I'm showing you in the first class all of these images already, as I did anything but trauma-informed way of learning. And now I'm doing it very differently. But that brings up a very critical question of subjectivity also. And I'm only beginning now to learn about how to have a research framework for critically addressing subjectivity. Now, you know that, Katie, but I learned that through working with art, centering arts-based research, centering survivor stories, all the critical issues in Holocaust studies need to come up, bubble up, need to be discussed. So this is not a process that simplifies or creates a perfunctory rendering. On the contrary, mm-hmm. the question of subjectivity oftentimes is dismissed there is a commitment to rigorous historiographical methodology. And of course, all of this matters. Of course, we have to study the Holocaust very well. Of course, it's a very distinct, unique event, and we need to have evidence-based learning. But we need to have an understanding of what it does to us as human beings, as scholars, because we too can be severely and deeply impacted by that trauma. And so how can we have a community of care for ourselves and then address the toll it takes on us and find that care toward ourselves and me as a faculty, as a mentor, as a supervisor, also be responsible for my student and make sure the learning and teaching that's happening is trauma-informed.
If we go right to the most arresting photos of events, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're educating them in a way that makes them kinder people who can connect with the humanity in someone else. So many threads of connection were completely destroyed by the Holocaust.
Yes, and so here's a whole other part I think we need to be much more mindful, because if we deal with very violent histories, what does the violence do to us as researchers? Mm-hmm. Again, we can pretend we can totally remove ourselves and we are the objective scholars, which we are, yet in order to really be compassionate and passionate about the work we do, we need to care. So we have that subjective element. As I tell to my student, I think it's okay to cry because it is absolutely heartbreaking. And as scholars, I think not to acknowledge that what we see is the absolute worst of humankind, what a human being is capable to do to another human being. And if we just see this as cold, harsh research, we're missing an important conversation and component, especially if we want to bring it into a larger human rights conversation and have young people become advocates for human rights and take ownership and are able to critically bring the history and learning and teaching about the Holocaust in conversation with contemporary human rights abuses.
What you are doing in this research project is to not go into those hard moments in the case of the individuals you are working with, to not see them only as the worst thing that happened to them, but to let them exist as full humans who then went on to live lives and have families and try to navigate what is it like to live with PTSD and, post that trauma. But if we don't make a very direct effort to integrate them in their story before the Holocaust and their story after the Holocaust, then it can be a dehumanizing kind of research endeavor as well.
I don't want to generalize, but I think many of us, when we learn about the Holocaust, what comes to mind is really atrocity photography, yeah. is, of course, photographs that have been taken without the consent and show explicit scenes, nakedness, explicit scenes of sometimes mutilation of a person in their either already close to death, dying, or in the process of being murdered. And that's the reference we have. And it's important to know, and it's important to see. And this is all forensic evidence. And of course, it's highly relevant. It matters, particularly in times of Holocaust denial or Holocaust relativization. But I'm less convinced that it is the most effective, thoughtful tool to get particular students to get them into action. The fact that I myself was almost giving up because I just couldn't see it. I couldn't experience it anymore.
Yeah, which is more, I think, a process of saying, here are photos of people being traumatized, and I'm going to traumatize you by just putting it in front of you, sometimes without context or without the ability to sort through that. And then sometimes what the viewer is dealing with isn't a reaction to them actually connecting to the subject or to the topic at hand, but them responding to the image of trauma. And so they have to sort through that, which can kind of look like they've made some progress in connecting with whatever the topic is, but it's really just them having some reaction to a traumatic photo or, you know, film or something like this.
So, and oftentimes a person shuts down. So this is what happened when I go on social media and I see atrocity photography. Mm-hmm. I literally cannot hold space. I can't bear it. Mm-hmm. And I think, how come if I can't see it, and I've seen so many of them, but I cannot. It's like in a picture then that's raw and it becomes imprinted in my brain, it destroys me. But these pictures need to exist, and they need to be collected, and they hold, they are of a high historical cultural relevance. But for teaching purposes, I think centering the voice of the survivor, letting the survivor take the lead, allowing them to share what they want to share, allowing them to change what they want to share. You know, what the process was very interesting when the artist started showing the first drawings, and then sometimes survivor says, "Oh, I don't like that. I could you please show it differently?" One survivor was a former engineer, so it was very important for him that certain aspects were correctly captured, but he cared less about how he was represented. And Emmy. Sometimes didn't like how her facial features were represented, whereas Rolf and Nico Kamp, I think they gave full license, artistic license to Gilad, but it was their choice. Nobody interfered in that process. And, you know, the relationship, going back to the book, were very different. They were not all the same way. Some were closer, some were more intimate, some were more professional. Mm-hmm. Again, it was their decision. And that's the critical part. It's also a form of self-documentation for the survivor. So we didn't ask them to draw themselves anything. But again, I think the relationship part is, for me, in all of this, the most critical aspect. If this work we do, that can be extremely isolating, that can be devastating, particularly for a young scholar, if this is part of this work, we think in terms of community building, community support, community solidarity within the research team, we are here to support one another. This could really be a complete shift in how we envision research on this topic.
Instead of an isolated sort of genius kind of working on their own to come up with a masterpiece, it's collaborative, it's within a team. And I think one of the things that I love most about working collaborative is things will happen in my own work that wouldn't have existed if I wasn't in communication and connection with another person on the team. That person draws the work out of me and is necessary to advance the entire project.
May I ask you, do you want to say a little bit more about that process and how you, as an artist, as a scholar that works in arts-based research, approaches the topic? And because it's obvious that you have a great care for your research team too, so I just want to understand that a little bit.
Yeah, my work as an artist, I'm oftentimes going through a process that I would label as hunting a mystery. If I don't have a really good question to push into as an artist, something that I don't understand, or it kind of has a hook that grabs me in some way, if I don't find that, then I can't make. I try to understand things by making through them. If I come to it with the answer already, then what's the point of making the work?
I showed the process of designing the cover of Barbara Yalin's new collaborative work with Emmy Abel, which is called Emmy Abel, The Color of Memory.
Yeah, and so that iteration, though, you said, well, this isn't quite right, maybe this title or this background, but she's making all of the covers. She's working through that question to arrive at what is a brilliant cover and a brilliant title that you all came up with. But that's an iterative process, to not say, I made one thing, I'm done. So the digital studies team that I work on, we showed one Power BI visualization this morning. To make that one, we made 40. And each time, we're asking new questions of the visualization. Well, what if it's like this, or what if it's like that? And we keep all of those so we can reference back to them. But in my own work as an artist, I'll make things 100 times before I feel like I've settled on something. And sometimes that process then becomes the work that I share. The iterations become the work. And other times, they're just me trying to work out the idea. And we kind of have this in writing where we'll make drafts of things, but it's a bit different to give as much weight to a drawing or a sketch as you do to a manuscript. And that's a direction I would like to see process and practice-based research go, is to give as much value to each medium as we give to written text.
Could you see then an exhibition or a publication where you show the stages of the work? So from the original design to the finished.
Yeah, exactly.
But again, we say finished project, but what I learned through this graphic novel project, each iteration is also a finished project in itself.
Right.
So the transcript is something, and then the drawings. Something begets something else, but nothing is produced without constantly being referenced by everything else. So you said it beautifully. So through the creative process, the process of creation, the questions emerge, the direction shapes up, new questions come up, all questions disappear, and it's the process again and again and again. And that can be very slow, and the research output can be relatively small and minor. And here, I also want to say we need funding agencies that recognize this kind of work. It is not like 100 papers that come out of there. There might be just one creative piece and a publication about the process-based work and a lot of drawings that end up in an archive that can be indexed. But the research output is going to be very different too.
Thank you so much for having time to sit down to talk on the Ackerman Center podcast.
It was a real honor and pleasure to be asked so many smart questions. And just again, each conversation allows me to think through the process. I did not come to this as an artist or as a community engaged researcher. It really helped. It's all about questions. I have very few answers, but the questions really are stimulating, we want to be always unsettled, and we want to, in a way, always question the practice we just adopted. We want to advance it, recalibrate it. And so, thank you. I really enjoyed that very much.
This podcast is hosted by a team of dedicated faculty and research assistants at the Ackerman Center for Holocaust Studies. You can learn more about our work and find upcoming events at our website, www.ackerman.utdallas.edu.